Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with our analysis of how Germany has maintained post-World War II control over the economies of the countries that had been occupied during World War II, this by way of understanding the historical background to the European Monetary Union. There are many important events taking place around the world, but I think the coming of the European Monetary Union and its realization is likely to prove most decisive. I've talked about the European Monetary Union in numerous programs, a half-hour segment called The Coming of the European Monetary Union, then a pair of half-hour segments accessing an article from Foreign Affairs Digest put out by the Council on Foreign Relations, a key American elite group. That article was read into the record in its entirety in a pair of half-hour segments from the spring of 1998. Then I did a pair of half-hour segments in January of 1999 talking about the very real possibility of the dollar being replaced to a large extent by the euro as a reserve currency, which could have a disastrous effect on the U.S. economy. And also, there could very easily be a currency speculation between the dollar and the euro, which could be utterly devastating not only to the U.S. economy, but to the world economy as well. In order to understand what the European Monetary Union really is, it's important to understand that it represents not only the fulfillment of the plans for conquest of Friedrich Liszt, a pan-German theoretician and chauvinist who wrote in the 1840s, it also represents the fulfillment of the theories of Karl von Clausewitz, the famous Prussian military theoretician, who observed that, quote, war is the continuation of politics by other means, unquote. The reverse is also true, as the Germans realized that politics and also economics is the continuation of war by other means, and their realization of that interrelationship between military, political, and economic matters has led to the success of the Prusso-Teutonic and Pan-German theoreticians, and that in turn resulted in the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization and the control by the Underground Reich of the European economies. And again, although this will appear to be utter drivel to members of the listening audience, the Third Reich did not disappear at the end of World War II, but rather went underground, and the single most important component of that is the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. In the last half-hour segment, we examined how IG Farben, among other companies, helped to maintain German economic hegemony in Europe even after the German armies had left. The German corporatist strategy for conquest is something that we've talked about in numerous programs, including a pair of half-hour segments called Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow and Part 2 of German Corporate Control over American Publishing. And again, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, one of the central elements in that control, along with patent technology that was controlled by IG Farben and other key German corporations. Near the end of our last half-hour segment, we were talking about the collaboration between French and industrialists and financiers and their German counterparts before and during the occupation. That collaboration and the economic relationships formed during the German occupation of France and other occupied nations was essentially continued in the post-World War II period. That's why I refer to the European Monetary Union as essentially a German creature. For our information, we're going to turn to one of the most remarkable books ever written, a book that I've been accessing quite a bit over the last couple of years, entitled Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning. That book was published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. I understand there's also a soft cover, a cloth cover edition that's available from the Carroll Publishing Group, which apparently is still in print, although not easy to find, so listeners might want to get a hold of that book. Bear in mind that Paul Manning was part of the CBS radio team that covered the war in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, and was one of the most remarkable journalists of our time, and his absolutely remarkable book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, might very well turn out to be the most important book ever written, the one that has been sadly submerged by critical hostility and institutional opposition on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, we read about how the Third Reich, as it prepared to go underground, felt it was in a position, and accurately felt it was in a position, to maintain economic control in the countries of occupied Europe even after the German troops left. This was the goal of the German corporatist strategy of conquest that we read about in that pair of excerpts from The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson. Again, that book, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, is copyrighted 1995 by Common Courage Press. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, I'm going to very slightly overlap the last passage we read with this one by way of establishing... I'm going to overlap the last passage we read into this half-hour segment by way of establishing an element of continuity. The large French chemical interests of Kuhlmann also had their agreements with IG Farben industry long before the war. Then, when France fell, this relationship ripened, expanding into full German majority control and stock ownership. The IG board of directors formed a new French holding company capitalized at 800 million francs and named it Francolor. It held the stock of Kuhlmann and other French dye and chemical interests. 51% of Francolor's stock was acquired by IG Farben Industry, without whose basic patents no chemical company in Europe could operate. The Germans were also diligent in acquiring stock control in other prime industries, and when their troops were forced from France in 1944, their economic imprint would remain. And indeed, that economic imprint has remained and has remained as the dominant element in European economics, albeit a clandestine element in the post-World War II period. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The characteristic secrecy surrounding the actions of German industrialists and bankers during the final 9 months of the war, when Bormann's flight capital program held their complete attention, was also carried over into the post-war years when they began pulling back the skeins of economic wealth and power that stretched out to neutral nations of the world and to formerly occupied lands. There was a suggestion of this in France. Flora Lewis, writing from Paris in the New York Times of August 28, 1972, told of her conversation with a French publisher, quote, "It would not be possible to trace ownership of corporations and the power structure as in the United States. Quote, they, unquote, would not permit it. Quote, they, unquote, would find a way to hound and torture anyone who tried, unquote, commented the publisher. They seem to be a fairly small group of people who know each other, but many are not at all known to the public. They, quote, unquote, move in and out of government jobs, but public service apparently serves to win private promotion rather than the other way around. The government, quote, control, unquote, that practically everyone mentions cannot be traced through stock holdings, regulatory agencies, public decisions. It seems to function through a maze of personal contacts and tacit understandings, unquote. And Manning goes on to write, "The understandings arrived at in the power structure of France reach back to pre-war days, were continued during the occupation, and have carried over to the present time." Lewis, in her report from Paris, commented further, quote, "This hidden control of government and corporations has produced a general unease in Paris," unquote. Along with the unease, the fact that France has lingering and serious social and political ailments is a residue of World War II and of an economic occupation that was never really terminated with the withdrawal of German troops beyond the Rhine. It was this special economic relationship between German and French industrialists that made it possible for Friedrich Fleck to arrange with the De Wendel firm in France for purchase of his shares in his Ruhr coal combine for $45 million, which was to start him once more on the road back to wealth and power after years in prison following his conviction at Nuremberg. By the way, De Wendel is capital D-E hyphen capital W-E-N-D-E-L. Manning goes on to write, "West Germany's economic power structure is fueled by a two-tier system. The corporations and individuals who publicly represent the products that are common household names around the world, and the secretive groups operating in the background as holding companies, and who pull the threads of power in overseas corporations established during the Bormann tenure in the Third Reich. As explained to me, quote, these threads are like the strands of a spider's web, and no one knows where they lead except the inner circle of the Bormann organization in South America," unquote. And Martin, bit of over-the-counter radio there, folks, when I reach back for some more text. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, there's discussion of how the 750 corporate fronts that were set up as vehicles by the Bormann Flight Capital Program functioned in conjunction with other masked subsidiaries of the major German corporations. And in turn, this maze, this spider's web, has led to German and underground domination of the economies of Europe in the post-World War II period. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, we read, even today, however, there are U.S. Treasury old-timers of World War II still not aware of the magnitude of the Bormann operation and of its success. Those who know, in Washington, in South America, and in the capitals of Europe, are locked together in a conspiracy of silence that has endured for 37 years until the publication of this book. In this silent contest during the wind-down years of World War II, Orvis A. Schmidt was not to emerge victor over Martin Bormann, although he tried. Tirelessly, he told assorted Senate committees what was happening, spoke of the extent of the German plan, and urged a new dedication to stopping the flight capital blitzkrieg with the prescient warning, quote, "It is these new concentrations of economic power which will enable Germany to rise again," unquote. Orvis A. Schmidt felt that he was a man crying in the wilderness as he gave testimony before Senate committees. The mood of the country and the marketplace was similar. Get our boys home and get on with the business of making money and building new homes and stabilizing the economy for the bumper crop of babies which was sure to come. When Orvis Schmidt told the senators the extent of German economic infiltration into the foreign countries even before VE Day, and that the Germans intended to preserve this vast hidden economic structure in order to rise again, he knew instinctively that he had failed to catch the interest of the American lawmakers. Schmidt testified, quote, "The danger does not lie so much in the fact that the German industrial giants have honeycombed the neutrals, Turkey, and Argentina, with branches and affiliates which know how to subvert their commercial interests to the espionage and sabotage demands of their government. It is important and dangerous, however, that many of these branches, subsidiaries, and affiliates in the neutrals, and much of the cash, securities, patents, contracts, and so forth, are ostensibly owned through the medium of secret numbered accounts or rubric accounts, trusts, loans, holding companies, bearer shares, and the like by dummy persons and companies claiming neutral nationality and all of the alleged protection and privileges arising from such identities. The real problem is to break the veil of secrecy and reach and eliminate the German ability to finance another world war. We must render useless the devices and cloaks which have been employed to hide German assets." Schmidt noted the facts that AEG, that's German General Electric, by the way, one of the major German cartels that was financed by American industry and finance in the first of the five major tides of capital flow of the 20th century that I talked about in those pair of half-hour segments, by the way, also discussed in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and numerous other archive shows available from Spitfire. Continuing again, Schmidt noted that noted the facts that AEG had six subsidiaries in Argentina, one in Portugal, two in Spain, three in Sweden. Siemens Schuckert Werke AG with seven subsidiaries in Argentina, two each in Portugal and Sweden, four in Spain, and five in Switzerland, and that Vereinigte Stahlwerke, and now, by the way, Thyssen AG, interrupting, had seven subsidiaries in Argentina, three affiliates in Spain, and four in Sweden, and so on almost ad infinitum. He was to save perhaps his best shot for IG Farben when he testified before a U.S. Senate committee, quote, "We have found an IG Farben list of its own companies abroad and at home, a secret list hitherto unknown, which names over 700 companies in which IG Farben has an interest," unquote. And this did not include their regular corporate structure in 93 countries or the 750 companies established under the Martin Bormann program. He also recited the discovery of his former chief, John Peel, P-E-H-L-E, now directing the War Refugee Board at the request of President Roosevelt. IG Farben, at the insistence of Himmler, and for related political reasons, had built a vast industrial establishment at Auschwitz to manufacture synthetic oil and rubber. Himmler promised Farben officials an unending supply of Jews in the 300,000 population concentration camp to work IG Farben Auschwitz. But even Friedrich Fleck and other Ruhr industrialists, who were themselves utilizing supplies of slave labor in their factories to the West, knew production could only be maintained with well-fed workers, not emaciated walking skeletons as at Auschwitz. It was IG Farben's greatest failure. Despite a plant which used more electricity than the city of Berlin, an investment of 900 million Reichsmarks, and 25,000 inmates who were worked until they dropped dead, not a single pound of Buna rubber was ever produced. It was the last time that political considerations would influence business judgment in the establishment of a factory, decreed the I.G. Farben Board of Directors. Orvis Schmidt also testified that when they questioned the top Farben people about their wartime activities, quote, they were inclined to be very indignant. Their general attitude and expectations was that the war was over, and we ought now to be assisting them in helping to get I.G. Farben and German industry back on its feet. Some of them have outwardly said that this questioning and investigation was, in their estimation, only a phenomenon of short duration, because as soon as things got a little settled, they would expect their friends in the United States and England to be coming over. Their friends, so they said, would put a stop to activities such as these investigations and would see that they got the treatment which they regarded as proper and that assistance would be given to them to help reestablish their industry. And then Manning goes on to comment, as the war came to a close, all major American industries felt that they would like to see the German money machine working again. Every U.S. company of consequence had its representative in uniform, as technical advisor or officer, as did the British. As Allied armies moved through France, Belgium, and the lowlands, corporate executives took time out to check the status of their branch firms. The changing tone seemed auspicious to Martin Bormann. In all lands liberated by British and American armies, there was a reluctance to disturb the machinery of money and industry that had been shaped by the German economic experts into cartels and interlocking business agreements with German firms. By the way, this reestablishment of the economic status quo in Germany and elsewhere by people connected with the very American industrial and financial firms that had capitalized Nazi Germany to a large extent to begin with is discussed in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, available from Spitfire. This next passage, again, repeating the last sentence because it's a key one. In all lands liberated by American and British armies, there was a reluctance to disturb the machinery of money and industry that had been shaped by German economic experts into cartels and interlocking business agreements with German firms. The obvious inequities and seizures were adjusted. The paintings taken from the Rothschilds were returned, as was the family bank. Firms and newspapers that had been too blatantly Nazi changed hands or were closed down. The German presence was reduced, but not eliminated. The device of cloaked ownership ensured a continuation of proprietary rights. It all added up to a new chapter in the adventures of the U.S. and in the adventures of the U.S. Army investigative teams. Grim idealists, when they entered the liberated countries, they soon learned that once free, each government haughtily insisted on making its own decisions without advice even from the Americans. Manning then goes on to comment about how Luxembourg exemplifies the post-World War II German control of the European economies. Even Grand Duchess Charlotte of Luxembourg had her own ideas, and they didn't jibe with those of the U.S. investigative team dispatched to her tiny country to set things right. Upon her return from exile in London and Montreal, she promptly dismissed the U.S. investigative mission, which had been attempting to uncover secrets of the German-Luxembourg steel cartel. Elbert D. Thomas of Utah, when he was chairman of the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Military Affairs, commented in Washington on June 26, 1945, quote, we had a mission in Luxembourg which was obtaining quite a bit of information on the steel cartel until the Grand Duchess returned. Information was then blocked off from us, and the mission had to retire with what information they had already collected. There was much to learn about the way in which small states like Luxembourg had been used by the cartels. The episode suggests that some rulers whom we have befriended may be expected to assist the cartelists in their post-war efforts to regain dominance. Unquote. When the Grand Duchess learned from her finance minister, what the Grand Duchess learned from her finance minister on her return to Luxembourg was simple, quote, don't tamper with the money machine. We made record profits during the German era, and there is every indication we will be going into an even greater period of prosperity once Germany recovers. They will then continue to be our biggest customer. All that is required now is a readjustment in stock ownership to please Belgian, French, British, and American shareholders, which will be done, unquote. Open German stock ownership was reduced to its former position of about 20% in Luxembourg industry, and the German trustee was eliminated. But at board meetings, Belgian and French banks voted as blocks on behalf of stockholders in Germany. The German voice in the wings was still there, and as time went on in Luxembourg, increasingly, the voice could be heard loud and clear. the customer speaking to the seller, the equalizer of the marketplace. Grand Duchess Charlotte, who was to retire during the 60s to be succeeded by her son, Grand Duke Jean, always believed that the new prosperity of Luxembourg after the war was testimony to her decision in 1945 not to permit interference with the German financial and industrial apparatus. The German banks, Deutsche and Dresdner, remained in position, and the Luxembourg financial community continued to look to Frankfurt rather than to Zurich, London, and New York for financial guidance. Arbed, its sales organization in New York, is Amerlex Products, continues as a powerful and prosperous steel cartel closely tied to its German mentors. By 1980, Luxembourg was to become a new center for gold buying in Europe, with West German banks selling the equivalent of $1.4 billion in gold to holders in Luxembourg. And again, this powerful alliance between those who had collaborated with the Nazi industrial machine, helping to see to it that the post-war German control, the type of long-term integrated economic and military policy envisioned by both people like von Clausewitz and also by Friedrich Liest, and realized with the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization and what I have termed the Underground Reich, this is what has given Germany the control of post-World War II Europe. Basically, the military conquest was used to promote the dominance of German corporations, and the German corporatist strategy for conquest was then realized. And the control of patent technology, the control of various key personnel who had collaborated, and the corporate interlocks of various German corporate subsidiaries, and also the 750 Bormann flight capital fronts, have helped to assure that post-World War II economic control. And I'm going into this again as part of the significance of this being that underlying the European Monetary Union is the fruit of this German corporatist strategy for conquest and its ultimate manifestation, which is the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. By the way, remember something that I pointed out in our that we analyzed in our discussions with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer. Professor Stauffer is a consultant who operates a firm that advises corporations and small countries on matters European. They have an explicitly anti-fascist perspective. And Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants was my guest in a number of different broadcasts from 1993 and 1994, those available from Spitfire. And one of the things Professor Stauffer pointed out was that, first of all, there is a major and a very important German law that no foreign interest can own a controlling interest in any major German corporation. Again, no foreign interest can hold a controlling interest in any German core corporation. Of course, the key German corporations own controlling interest in many, many firms around the world, including now the American publishing industry. And bear in mind that what educated Americans are going to be knowing about the world, about World War II, about the Third Reich, the Holocaust, the whole nine yards, is going to come now from German-owned publishers tied in with the Underground Reich and the Bormann Organization. And bear in mind that what uneducated Americans are going to know about the world is going to come from educated Americans. Bear in mind another point that we discussed with Professor Stauffer, namely that the key directors of the German core corporation sit in on German cabinet meetings, and that in turn German cabinet ministers sit in on the board of director meetings of the major German core corporations. This permits an integration of political and economic strategy that exceeds any that any other country has been able to put together. And one of the differences between German corporations and corporations that are operated out of other countries, such as American transnationals, is that the American transnationals aim at profit only. The German corporations, obviously out to make profits, are very conscious of themselves as manifestations of Germany, and they are out for Germany in a nationalistic and geopolitical sense in a way that American corporations aren't. American corporations are in one sense sort of apolitical. They aim at profits, and they certainly pull a lot of powerful political strings in the United States and elsewhere, but the goal is profits. The German core corporations tied in at the bottom with the Borman Flight Capital Organization are not only interested in producing profits, but in turn in using those profits to help finance the rebirth of Nazism, or really the reemergence of Nazism. It never went away. And in turn, the German corporations are very conscious of their roles as German entities and as integrated elements of a German foreign and economic policy that was formulated by Friedrich Liest and ultimately realized during the Third Reich and the post-World War II Underground Reich and the Bormann Organization. Again, it's important to remember that underlying the European Monetary Union is German economic control of Europe. The European Monetary Union is a consummately important event, and underlying German economic control of Europe is the Bormann Flight Capital Organization that I've spoken about before. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, of the Bormann Flight Capital Program, we read, "The movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well," Bormann noted from his reports. "Flight capital investments had been accomplished principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. A holding company may not trade in any form. It may only hold stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals of Europe and to the countries of South America. A control that continues today," by the way, Manning was writing in 1981, "and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. Bearer shares require no registration of identity, for such shares are exactly what they mean. The bearer of the majority shares controls the company without needing a vestige of proof as to how he acquired them. Thus, the Germans who participated as a silent force in Bormann's post-war commercial campaign, which is sometimes referred to by aging Nazis as Operation Eagle's Flight or Aktion Adlerflug, ensured their command over the industrial and financial institutions that were to move the new Federal Republic of Germany back into the forefront of world economic leadership." And again, that is true of the reunified Germany as it was of West Germany, which existed in Paul Manning's time. Bear in mind that that book was published in 1981. So again, I can appreciate that this might appear to be repetitive or irrelevant to some members of the listening audience, but it's important to understand history. As I like to say, if you don't study history, the world is a mystery. Read or bleed. Learn or burn. And the fact of the matter is, it's vital to understand history, such as the Friedrich Liest formulation for German economic conquest and world domination. And it's important to understand the Bormann Organization, the German corporatist strategy for empire, in order to understand the European Monetary Union. And the effects of that are going to be enormous. And again, one of the central points that I try to emphasize to people is that the Third Reich did not disappear. It went underground, and it's as real today as I speak in 1999 as it was in 1939, and a hell of a lot more deadly than it was 60 years ago because nobody knows it exists. And that is the point of many of the programs that I do. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.